Front Blues Festival is the largest blues festival west of the Mississippi. The festival features more than 100 performances on 4 stages, including the Robert Cray Band, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Trombone Shorty, and Vintage Trouble. There will also be workshops, cruises on the Willamette River, activities for kids, after-hour jams, fireworks, and more. Again, that's the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next, the Dirtbag takes on raspberries, hot weather gardening, planting for fall and winter, and fig evaluation project.
Hiring a news and public affairs director to manage the evening news and public affairs programming and to train and supervise volunteers. For this full-time position, we're looking for someone with proven experience in news and public affairs production, management and supervisory skills with volunteers with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. People of color and women are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven, natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
Well, Jim, we've reached the second Wednesday of the month. It's time for the Dirtbag.
That's right, and it's June.
It feels like August.
Summer has arrived.
Well, you're listening to the Dirtbag. This is Glenn Andreessen. To my right, in your both ears, is Jim Gilbert, preparing for his Around the World in 14 Days trip.
Did you ever see the movie Around the World in 80 Days?
Did.
I love that film, although I don't remember much about it, so now I want to see it again. I don't think there was jet airplanes involved.
You know, another movie that I remember, maybe one of the first ones that ever registered for me, is It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Mm. You ever see that one?
I think so, but that sounds like another one to watch, you know, in those winter, not now.
Yeah. All right. Well, welcome to The Dirtbag, a program dedicated to edible gardening and things surrounding that. Full show today, but of course we always have time for your questions and answer in the case of the garden stumper. 503-231-8187 is the number to call with a gardening question. Heck, we don't care what kind of question it is, do we, Jim? We'd handle it.
That's right. Or we'll pass it along.
We've got opinions. In fact, I'm thinking maybe we should start out with what's annoying Glenn this month, because we never get to it at the end. I forget.
Okay.
I'll get to that after I'll give you a rundown of the show that we have lined up for today. Our plant of the month, raspberries. According to my records, we've never talked about raspberries in a little more depth. So we're hitting that today.
You know what? I wish we could have had some to eat.
I have eaten a few.
Have you?
Yes, some of the everbearings.
One of the fellows that where I work with told me this morning about yesterday he picked 8 pounds of raspberries in Aurora.
Well, it's going to be the season for that. We will return again to this hot weather gardening, and particularly the watering. Or is that irrigation?
You know, for plants and pots, I'd call it watering. For fields, let's call
it's irrigation.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, so watering.
Yeah.
Right, we've got our garden stumper at half past the hour. Jim has a fig evaluation project going on that we'll talk about, not necessarily tasting yet. Seems like the figs are pretty big already, but they're not edible yet, the Desert Kings.
There's a ways yet to go.
Yeah. They'll be next month, though, for the Desert Kings here.
Yep.
And if we have time, let's see, I'll talk about saving seeds. Probably not going to get to that. And Jim will also talk about his around the world in 14 days, starting in New Jersey, going to Russia.
Uzbekistan.
And then Korea. And then flying back over the Pacific.
That's right.
Yep, that really is around the world.
Yep.
Amazing. You're 14 days. How many days sitting on your butt in the airplane or airport?
You know, well, so there's the flight from here to New Jersey, 6 hours. And then we spend a day in New Jersey visiting an apricot breeder and my partner's mother. And then at noon the next day, we fly from JFK, the only airline that flies direct to Uzbekistan is Uzbek Airlines, as you might imagine. That's 12 hours. And it flies, so you leave at noon approximately on that day, the 27th, and we arrive 12 hours later in Tashkent in the morning.
That morning.
Yeah, right. So actually the next morning. So that means
you start
a new day and your evening nighttime consists of 12 hours on an airplane.
Yeah. Of course, that's just the airplane. Then we got a couple hours either side of that flight.
Yeah, that's
at least you probably have at least 3 days of airport and travel time.
Yeah.
It's worth it. All right. Okay, what's annoying me this month? This isn't really annoying me this time, but it's why don't we in the city of Portland have more yield signs? Why do we need to put stop signs up every corner? Maybe that's to reduce speed is fine. But really all we want to do is who has the right of way? Then a yield sign seems like it would do just fine.
And to add to that, in New Zealand, they have basically converted, at least we noticed, we don't know what it was like before because we hadn't been there before, but they have roundabouts everywhere. And I understand there's some potential now to have some roundabouts out in rural Clackamas County. I heard proposals for
I've seen them in, there is one in rural Clackamas County out Happy Valley Way. I've seen it put in a brand new one.
Yeah.
But there's stop signs at them.
Oh, not supposed to be stop signs.
No, that's to keep the traffic flowing.
Yeah.
A yield sign would work well there.
Yeah.
So you see a car coming, you yield to it.
Right. People have to get used to roundabouts, but in New Zealand, and then the funny thing about New Zealand is you go the opposite direction. You don't.
Oh.
So you got to keep that in mind, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, anyway, that was on my mind this month.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's start with our... Before we go to talk about raspberries, let's talk to Mimi.
Okay.
Good morning, Mimi. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hey, glad I caught you today. So I have two questions. One is it too hot now to put in a second batch of radishes? And if so, if it's not too hot, do I still need to cover them so that they don't attract the moths which lay the eggs which bore through them?
Well, the issue with the heat would be, can it get germinated? And I might not do it today, but from now on, you could probably do that all right. Because if you kept them moist and you kept them covered for germination, it will happen. They'll germinate. But the key is keeping them moist. Because once it starts germinating, they can't dry out at all. Before they germinate, they don't care if they're wet or dry. But, you know, in temperatures like this, they'll germinate pretty quickly. So what I would probably do is, not today, but after today, seed them as you normally would, and then cover them either with fine compost or maybe even burlap so you can keep that moist.
Okay, I have row cover.
Work fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
And covering them with row cover, and I'm talking about before they germinate.
Right.
Okay. And you're probably talking about, well, what about the row cover after they germinate and start forming.
I would still put the row cover on anyway, right after I seed them.
I would.
Yeah.
If you have
so,
a problem.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for that. And then one more question is, when do I want to get my fall winter beets in?
Now and up to the end of July.
Okay.
They could be seeding for those.
Okay,
I haven't seeded beets at all, but that's on my list of things to do this week.
I just did that a couple days ago before the heat wave, and I wasn't sure if I could do it again in a couple weeks for more for later. So, okay,
yeah.
Great.
One tip that I will pass along for beets is that you may know that each seed that you plant is really a compound seed, and there'll be one, two, three, even sometimes four little seedlings that will come up from the one little shriveled seed capsule mm-hmm. that you plant. And what I do, rather than seed a whole new row or something, is I will transplant three of them. Well, actually, I transplant all four. Let's say there's four of them there, and with a trowel or my fingers, if the soil is friable, is lift up the whole bunch, tease them apart, the roots, and then plant one back in that hole, and then transplant the other three into a new row or something like that. It accomplishes a couple of things at least. One is that you're going to have to thin those beets anyway. You know, four in one is, you're not going to get any good beets. They're going to be, their roots mm-hmm. are going to be entangled and whatnot. So you're going to have to do that anyway. So why not transplant them? Sure, it's a little extra set, but it's a lot less than planting a whole new row. By transplanting,
right.
you'll also, the seedling will experience transplant shock, which will put it back 2 or 3 weeks. That's about what you want. You know,
that's really interesting. I didn't know that. That's great. Okay.
So you can fill in a new row or fill in spaces in the existing row with that too.
Okay.
And of course, water them in. So this should be done, not today. It's just brutal out there. Yeah, transplanting something today.
All right.
It'll
not
just be flat on the ground after trying to transplant it there. But it could spring back.
Right.
So that's what I would do with beets.
Thanks very much.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
Bye. Bye.
Okay. On to raspberries. Our plant of the month. Well, Jim suggested this, but he said, well, I don't really know that much about these common, more common fruits. He had suggested honeyberry, too, which we've talked about in the last year and a half or something like that, plus your honeyberry project that's going on.
Yeah, I depend upon you, Glenn, to keep track of all these things.
Oh, so, I can't remember either, so I have to write them down.
That's really good.
Yeah. And according to my records, we haven't talked about raspberries per se. So.
And it's pretty timely.
Yes, raspberries are ripening now. The everbearing, the so-called everbearing or the fall bearing are producing now. The summer bearers will be coming on very quickly. Raspberries can be red, black, purple, yellow. I grow red and yellow. The yellows tend to be sweeter. They're a little more delicate. They don't hold up in the sun quite as well. But the cultivation of them is all the same. They're weedy. You know, that's one thing to keep in mind with raspberries, that if you're not on it, they'll be all over you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll come up in 2 feet away and then 6 feet away, and then they can just take over. Beware of that. Now, you don't have to. Most of them are the canes are quite tall. I mean, some of my varieties, or one of my varieties, the what I call Glenn's honey raspberry now, because I don't know what variety it is. The new canes will be, 10 feet tall. Very
wow.
vigorous.
That is really tall, Glenn.
Yeah. So what I do for any raspberry is, what I try to do with any raspberry is, already by now have selected the canes that I want to keep. just a little bit about raspberries. We're just going to talk about the summer bearers now, but they all kind of have this type of growth. The growth that's coming out now, the new growth from the ground.
Jenna has a question about raspberries.
They will be the ones that will be bearing fruit next year. So the ones that you keep are the ones that you bear fruit. But you shouldn't keep all of them because that's just way too many. It would make a much too dense of a patch. So for me, and mine are in a row that are on a trellis, so I can tie the canes to them. On some of my plants, I've already chosen which two canes I'm keeping, and I've cut out the other ones. And they might send a few more up still, but they might send up a dozen or more canes. And for me, an in-city gardener, I don't have the luxury of space. So by cutting them out now, I'm only dealing with two new canes rather than a dozen. And it doesn't hurt the plant at all, mm-hmm. at least in my experience it hasn't. I've done this for 20 years.
And how many old canes do you have that you're leaving? It's the same two, right? You've got
yeah.
two from the previous year.
Right. Those are the ones that are bearing fruit this year or will bear fruit right now. They're
so
still.
So you have a total of four canes then, one new, two
correct.
New ones.
And, yeah. yeah, about every 2 feet or so.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will remark, boy, that's not very many canes. But I get a lot of berries. Mm-hmm. And I would rather have fewer canes and fewer big berries than many berries and a little smaller one.
Right.
You know, it's the thinning process, if you will.
Right.
Now, you can prune your canes, you know, at 5 feet if you want. I don't, because they will produce fruit on laterals from the main canes that you leave. That's where the fruit are. The fruit doesn't spring forth, if you will, from the main cane. They send out lateral shoots, and that's where the berries are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you cut it off at 5 feet, you're just going to have fruit on laterals from, well, where do they start, you know, 2 feet up to 5 feet up. For my tall canes that are 8 or 10 feet tall, I loop them over, and so mm-hmm. I have canes laterals, and hence fruit production coming from the whole cane. And, you know, some of them are pretty tall. Mm-hmm. You know, those canes are, you know, I have to reach to pick them.
Mm-hmm.
But so be it.
Yeah. Sounds great. It sounds delicious.
Well, next month, maybe you'll be back from your trip, hopefully, suffering jet lag, but maybe you'll be here. Hopefully you'll be here. And I'll try to remember to bring some of these yellow raspberries.
That'd be wonderful.
Because they're tasty, tasty.
My memory of raspberries goes back to when I was in grade school, and they used to, probably some people might, of a certain age might remember this, when actually children were taken off to go pick berries.
Those
buses would show up, and you'd go off, and I found out that I don't like doing that for money. Some people did, but it wasn't my thing.
Yeah, I used to do it. Rode a school bus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Never picked raspberries. That way, though.
Raspberries and beans seemed like they were the two main things. Might have been strawberries, too.
Strawberries was it in the mid-Willamette Valley, or near Eugene. That's the southern Willamette Valley.
Yeah.
Okay, staying with raspberries, it's Jenna. Pardon me?
Okay, so I have these raspberry plants, and I have not watered them. I've totally neglected them. But they're starting to fruit. Is there anything I can do at this point to make tasty raspberries? Because I've totally neglected these, and last year the fruit was terrible. I mean, they grew raspberries, but they're terrible. And I'm wondering, at this point, am I just too late, or is there like a last-minute saving grace that I can do for these berries?
Well, did you also not water them?
Yeah, no watering. Just natural rain. That's
okay.
What I call my watering.
Well, I saw on a newscast here recently that for this month we've had, I think, a total of 0.16 inches of rain. And that's not enough for raspberries. If you dig down there, it's going to be pretty bone dry probably.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's lost on, the season is lost. I think you could start watering them and pull out a good crop.
And a couple of questions come up. I mean, do you have mulch on the soil underneath the plants, or is it weeds, or what's the, is there other plants that are pulling out the moisture from your raspberries?
Yeah, I got some weeds down at the bottom because I've totally neglected them. They're just up against my fence, and I think of them kind of like as weeds that I just neglect, but I'm thinking, you know, I got this fruit on there.
Yeah.
What can be saved? So if I pull up my weeds around them and maybe like mulch the ground at this point, maybe I can still get some good fruit out of them.
But you need to water.
And the water.
Because even the plants themselves are pulling water. I mean, they're very big roots, not necessarily deep rooted, but surface. You know, they send out these runners. And I did some years ago, I left a cover crop in a bed, took out half of it, I think, and left half of it, and thinking that the one that I had taken out would dry out sooner because it was exposed to the sun and wind and whatnot. But to my surprise, it was the other way around. The cover crop side was much drier. And what I surmised from that was, well, the plants themselves are just using the water.
And when you have a weeds underneath plants that they're tough competitors. They'll take out the moisture before the plants even gets down to the roots.
Yeah.
So it's pretty important to eliminate the weeds.
Right. And putting on the mulch, you'll also start a very feeding the soil, mm-hmm. which will eventually feed the plant. I don't know, Jim, if a little bit of fertilizer now would help her for her fruit quality.
Yeah.
You know, the fruit is going to ripen within 2 or 3 weeks, so.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't make a difference. If the plants growing relatively vigorously? Or?
Yeah, they are. And so that's why I was thinking, you know, maybe I could do something, but because they're already fruiting, it feels sort of like, maybe this is just too late for this season, but I should take care of it for next season.
I'd get water to them.
Yep.
And see.
Okay.
And if you have willpower, you know, don't water one plant and see what the difference is between the watered plant and the unwatered plant.
Oh, I like the experiment. I'll try that out. Thank you for the advice.
You bet. Let us know. Okay, we're ready to head on. Well, let's head on to our first musical selection. Well, yes, not only in honor of Jim heading around the world, but since we're talking about raspberries, all of our selections today are by Chuck Berry.
Oh, amazing. That's a great song. I loved it.
I did a little research on that, or it's common knowledge, that Paul McCartney, when he wrote Back in the USSR, White Album, mm-hmm. first track, he based it, or it was in response to not only the Beach Boys, Chuck Berry, Back in the USA, which I just played, or Rave just played, but also Beach Boys, kind of a parody too there, in at least in the Beatles, the Back in the USSR, when they say, well, Georgia girls or whatever, you know, that's talking about like the California girls from the Beach Boys.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just sampling them, so to speak. Anyway, so we'll be coming up with some more Chuck Berry tunes, but not by Chuck Berry.
Uh-huh.
Covers, yes. Okay, well, let's get into this hot water weather, hot weather watering. I was just thinking on the way in as I biked in that I may, biking in for the Dirtbag Show, I don't know if it's ever been as warm as it's been as today.
Hmm. Well, 97 yesterday was what we had. And
well, I meant just at 10:30. You know, it's probably already 75, maybe pushing 80.
Yeah. And so far, it felt good. I mean, I was sitting outside the station, you know, I saw it in the shade, yeah. And I was fine. But I, soon, after the show, I get to I'll walk across town and I'll yeah. have a report.
It'll be a different tune there.
Yeah, yeah, right. Definitely.
So it's, you know, plants are going to be using a lot of water. They're going to be respirating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to know how much water is in the ground or when to water your plants. Now, all plants, or maybe not all plants, but for example, the broccoli plants or other members of the brassicas, they are going to be looking pretty wilty in hot weather. But come nightfall, then they'll perk right back up. It's just one of their defense mechanisms. So just because your plant is looking peaked doesn't mean that it's dead or going to die.
Don't have to freak out.
That's correct. No. Now, lettuces, on the other hand, they may actually get some of their leaves mortally wounded. You know, they'll just dry up and crispy and whatnot, which, of course, that means that part of the plant died. So, Jim, what would you say is the best way to determine the moisture content in your soil or related, does your plant need water?
Yeah, so, you know, at our nursery and farm, we have plants in the ground and we have plants in pots. Plants in the ground, generally speaking, are not in jeopardy. You know, they're not going to like it if they don't have adequate water, but they're probably not going to die. You know, they've got mm-hmm. enough. There's enough moisture in the soil itself to keep them going. In pots, it's a different story. And I was thinking about that on the way in about how, I mean, we really have to pay attention to pots because they dry out really quickly, and sometimes sneak up on you that drying and if they fully dry, they're done.
There's no coming back.
There's no coming back. So in the ground, we typically water a deep watering once a week. During the summer,
mm-hmm.
We use mulch. We keep the ground covered as much as possible. If you're growing fruit, you definitely want to not let plants get super dry. The plant again may survive, but fruit quality will not be good.
Right, so, as evidenced by, was it Jenna?
Yes, the raspberry situation.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with mulch and periodic deep waterings, that's the clue of keeping plants, you know, moist in the field, out in the ground, and weed control, as we said earlier, mm-hmm. is essential to keep. I was visiting my daughter in Salt Lake City a couple of weeks ago, and they had planted a cherry tree in their front yard, but they didn't take the grass away from around it. And that poor cherry tree was just, you know, it was alive. It had leaves on it. It had a couple of cherries, but it was not a vigorous plant. It needed to be freed of the grass. You know, the cherry liberation front needed to step in and get that grass away from around it. With pots, like I said, pots is a different story. And one way to measure the moisture in a pot, in fact, the way we do it, typically, is to actually pick the pot up if it's uh-huh. a size that you can do that. You can tell right away if you water a potted plant and fully, you can get a sense of the weight of a fully watered plant. And then as days pass, it will transpire, the moisture will mm-hmm. leave the pot, and then it will get lighter. And if it's light enough to toss it around, you've gone too far.
or if you see the soil pulling back from the edge of the pot, that's not a good sign.
That's a very bad sign.
One of the things that I do for my nursery stock that's in pots, you know, whether that's bee plants and, you know, non-edible plants, is this time of year I try to give them all trays to catch water.
Mm.
So it's just I'm not out there having to water or worry about watering, mm-hmm. you know, a couple times a day sometimes in, you
sure.
know, a 2 or 3 inch pot, they're going to dry, and they're in the sun, they're going to dry out pretty quickly in this type of.
So you're talking about a tray where you put water in the tray and the water moves up into the root system.
Yeah, or I water the soil and then whatever leaches out just is caught there.
And sticks around for a while. So
yeah, yeah, right. And yeah. It's, sure. You know, I don't worry too much or really at all about having the soil or the roots, you know, wet all the time, which they will be when there's water in the tray.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that it's just drying out. So it's better than drying out so quickly.
Yep. Yeah, it's a good plan. Another problem that can happen from severe wet and dry cycles, especially in potted plants, are spider mites and aphids that will are attracted by that plant in distress situation.
Right. And that reminds me too on just to mention a little bit about tomatoes, is that the uneven watering part, which can lead to what's known as blossom end rot.
Mm.
We wouldn't be seeing fruit necessarily yet, but soon there will be on the early varieties. But it's a calcium problem, and when the water is not moving because your plant dries out, then calcium is hard to move anyway in the plant and in the soil. And when it dries out, it's not calcium, it doesn't get to the plant.
Yep.
Or to the fruit.
I think it's also important to mention the dangers of overwatering.
Yeah.
I always like to talk about that a little bit because sometimes I can recall people talking to me about their having trouble with their plants where they've got them planted a fruit tree, for example, where they have vegetables or flowers and they're watering every day and the plant gets too much water.
Uh-huh.
And it just because it's hot doesn't mean that you need to soak the ground all the time. I mean, that's not good for it either.
Yeah.
Nature has a way of taking care of plants.
And, you know, if you're ever in doubt, you can just dig down a few inches into the soil see.
Yep.
I have laid on just about many things, just planting potatoes in the garden this week and digging holes with my post hole digger, and this is a bed that didn't have any supplemental water, just rainwater.
Mm-hmm.
And is just, you know, I wouldn't say bone dry, but certainly powdery dry.
Yep.
And so
2 days ago I was planting some trees in the field and noticed the same thing. I mean, the ground is dry.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of wonder, you know, sometimes, I mean, we talked about how little rain we've had in June. We didn't probably have a whole lot in May either. And this is typical for Oregon.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, we say that the summer starts on July 5th in Oregon or in Portland, mm-hmm. but not this year.
No.
Who knows?
Well, I think even the Rose Festival escaped major rainfall, surprisingly. But
yeah.
Good for them.
Well, that's okay. That's what we have to say about watering, not irrigating, watering. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, another thing that I'll mention about watering, though, is just a very simple tool that you can use, a watering device. Okay. Ready for this? Part of the problem is when you've just seeded something inside, more in a pot, or if you've just transplanted in a seedling, you know, how do you water that thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a hose in? No, that's just going to wash the thing away and soil and whatnot. So what I've used for a couple of decades now is a homemade watering device made from a milk jug or any type of a plastic container. I've acquired some tubing, either clear or black irrigation tubing. It can be just about any size, with an awl or a nail, if you will, a big nail or a spike, punch a hole into the bottom of the side at the bottom, but not on the bottom, on the side, with the spike, and then immediately force, don't make it too big, force the tubing, you know, what size tubing? Oh, you know, quarter of an inch tubing or something like that. Force it into the milk jug, and the plastic will then, after you pull out the awl or the nail or whatever, and you stick in your tubing, the plastic milk jug will then kind of spring back, filling in the hole and tightening that tube interface.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, it doesn't leak at all. And then, you know, you fill up your tube with water. And this way, you can control the flow by lifting it up higher or lower. And the tube, you know, you just use it like a... You direct the end of the other end of the tube onto your plant. Just used it one this morning. I was watering in some cucurbits.
Kind of like dribble squash. Irrigation.
Well, this is inside. I mean, in pots. But you know, right. You can control the flow, so it doesn't it doesn't wash away the soil or anything. Cheap, easy, and more effective than anything you could buy, I think.
Well, we do, and I don't know if you can buy them at regular stores, but in nursery supply stores, they sell a mist hose in.
Yeah.
And you put that on the end of your hose, and it just makes a fine mist. And just misting those seeds as they're germinating.
Yeah, that would work very well for, you know, fine seeds over a bigger area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well... You know what time it is, Jim?
I can guess.
Let's go for the garden stumper.
All right.
We got Ray. Okay, we're coming back to the raspberry theme here. It's a two-parter. What is each seed of a raspberry called, and about how many comprise a typical berry? This is, you know, these little seedy things with the fleshy pulp around a seed in a raspberry. What's that called, and about how many are in a typical raspberry? All right. Head to Google. Or try it first if you don't know it. If you want to take a stab at that, 503-231-8187, which also happens to be the same number to call if you have a question. 503-231-8187.
And we take both answers and questions.
Indeed we do, at the same number. Let's talk about your fig evaluation project.
Sure. Well, I would have to say that figs, along probably with apricots, are two of my very, very favorite fruits. And so over the years, figs have an interesting history in Oregon. And when I first started the nursery, I ran into a gentleman, Peter Dana, his name, who was growing a fig that he'd brought from Sicily in 1949 over in southeast Portland, among other fruits like persimmons and pawpaws and things. He was really a great guy, and I really very much appreciate getting to know him. He happened to have a catalog from a fig nursery from the 1920s in Portland. And following that history back, there was a gentleman named Fort Amon who brought, you know, I understand, 100 varieties of figs.
Goodness.
To the Portland area in the early 1900s.
So want to go back to clarify, this catalog was for a Portland company.
Yes.
That was offering
there
figs.
That was growing and selling figs. Yeah.
All right.
And so I know I've often wondered, I guess, and in the past anyway, well, you know, there were some old fig trees in people's backyards in Portland. I mean, and after learning more about this, discovered that what variety they were, and Latarula, which he named that, had a different Italian name, and that's one of the problems sometimes with figs is people put their own names on them.
And why did he name it that?
Who knows?
Okay.
He wasn't around for me to ask him, sadly.
Oh, okay. All right.
But anyway, so that's a pretty common fig, and people would tell me about this fig plant in my backyard, I want to get rid of it. But, you know, then I'd tell them, hey, you know, that's a beautiful fig tree, you know, take care of it and eat the fruit. So, but over the years, we discovered that there are, in fact, went to a fig conference in 2015 in Italy that we got more information. Different types of figs, and there's a type of fig called San Pedro. You might call it a class of figs. If you had fertile fig seeds and planted them, about 8% of the seedlings would be San Pedro types.
Really? Any type of fig?
Any fig.
Okay.
Right, any seed from a fig.
Now, from any fig.
From any fig. It has to be fertile seed, and that means it has to be pollinated, which is another story for another show probably. But at any rate, so you plant those seeds, and 8% of them could be San Pedro. The unique characteristic of a San Pedro fig is that it ripens its main crop on the wood that grew the previous year. And that ripening time is typically here in late July, early August.
So a Desert King must be a San Pedro type.
A Desert King is a San Pedro fig.
Okay.
And the benefit for Oregon is the west of the Cascade Mountains. Now, Portland is a little warmer than where we are out in the country. But the benefit of the San Pedro type is it's ripening when the weather's ideal.
Mm-hmm.
The fall ripening type figs will either ripen late or not ripen at all. The kinds from California, for example, Brown Turkey, Black Mission, Codota, struggle to ripen here. And you know, sometimes there are different kinds of Brown Turkey, so I may shouldn't have used that name, but Black Mission and Codota are typically not reliable fruit producers here in our region. There are some that are, like Latarula is pretty good for a fall fig. However, you can't beat the San Pedro type, I think, for our region.
What are some other varieties of San Pedro types besides Desert King?
Desert King is the only commonly grown one and the only one that's widely available here.
I see.
So some years ago, we were able to bring in some figs from Italy, and that's what we're doing now in our and also from... there's a repository of fig germplasm in Davis, California. There are other people in the state, in the country, that have figs that have collected them over the years. And so what we're doing now is we've planted out, I would say, probably at least 60 varieties of figs to do another fig evaluation, focused primarily on San Pedro types.
Yes.
To see what we can get, and we'll hopefully expand our fig varieties that we can grow here besides Desert King.
So that's information that I wasn't or didn't grasp earlier when we've talked about this through the years, that Desert King is really the only San Pedro type that's
one I know of. Another unique characteristic of San Pedro figs is that most figs bear two crops. The first crop is called the Breva crop. And even the fall ripening figs will bear that first crop, usually not as much. And that's why the San Pedro types are so valuable. The San Pedro will also bear a second crop, but the second crop has to be pollinated by the fig wasp.
But the first one doesn't.
The first one doesn't.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And when we were in Italy looking at these figs, we actually saw the fig wasp pollinating the second crop.
Do we even have the fig wasp here?
I've not seen it. I would love to hear if any listener has ever seen a fig wasp in Oregon. I'd love to hear about it. And the word wasp is sort of like a little overdone. I mean, these are basically fruit flies, size-wise. They're not stinging creatures that,
So they're not native here. And when you ask people, have you seen a fig wasp? Are you talking about the fig wasp or, whatever the scientific name is of that?
A
fig wasp. They just happened to see one.
Well, I think the fig wasp and a fig wasp probably are the same thing because the plant, the creature is so small, it has to be able to crawl in to this inside of the fig. And a garden stumper is stewing about in my brain right now. But,
okay.
So I won't give all the clues to that just yet.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating process in how the fig evolved to require this small little creature to pollinate it is one of those wonders of nature.
Right. Okay. Well, so keep us posted.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you evaluate. I mean, are they close to fruiting? I mean, they fruit the second year, so.
Yeah, they're close to fruiting. And this year, we just planted them out, actually, into our evaluation block. So it'll probably be next year before we have a reliable crop.
Yeah.
And what we'll be looking for, of course, is fruit quality, ripening time, plant vigor and health. But it'll be very interesting to see.
And are these seedlings that you're planting out or known species?
They're known species.
Okay, so
varieties.
You don't get to name one.
Well, you could if
rename.
It was, you could rename it. I mean, something like I don't know.
The Dirt Bag.
Glid's Glory.
I see you've done this before.
We did. We did name one a fig that years ago we got a fig from Texas that turned out to be a good variety, and we called it Vern's Brown Turkey after Vern Nelson, an Oregonian garden writer of great repute.
Did he grow it?
Yeah, I gave him plants. He planted on the south side of his garage. It did really well. We said, well, let's call it to distinguish it from other brown turkeys that aren't so reliable in our climate. We call it Vern's Brown Turkey.
But it's not a San Pedro.
It's not a San Pedro.
It's a, what's the other variety?
We call it fall ripening fig. What? It's common fig.
Okay. All righty. Well, let's move on to our second Chuck Berry tune. This is covered by the Steve Gibbons Band, which I'd be surprised if maybe anybody in our listening audience has heard of the Steve Gibbons Band. But back in the days, back in the 70s when I was doing college radio, I like this guy from England, and Steve Gibbons, and kind of a hard rocker. And then while I was in England, actually Scotland, my brother and I were traveling, and we went to an ELO concert, Electric Light Orchestra. But who opened it? Steve Gibbons Band.
Well, we better hear it.
Right. So this is their cover of the Chuck Berry song Tulane. Chuck Berry.
It's good.
Covered by the Steve Gibbons Band.
I like that you've brought Steve Gibbons back to our awareness. You know, I mean, that's really important. People do that kind of work. They shouldn't just be lost in obscurity.
Yes.
I have a little mission of my own that I'm trying to do.
Okay.
In the former Soviet Union, there was a lot of really good research done, and researchers who wrote books about things like sea berry and apricot and different things, and a lot of that work was never really known to the West, and the people that did it have kind of just, you know, nobody knows about them. So on a small scale, with my primitive skills at Russian, I'm working at trying to translate some of that.
And I
think that these people who did this wonderful work should be known.
Are they still, you're communicating with them?
No, these are people that have passed away.
And then where are you getting their work, their documents?
I have books that they've written.
Uh-huh.
Never were translated.
Well, that'd be one way to increase your Russian skills.
I know. Time is an issue right now.
Yeah,
you know, the
yeah.
late days, man. It's like tough to go out and not to go out, be out there potting plants.
Right.
So.
Well, somewhat regular feature that we talk about here is what's being harvested now. Are you harvesting anything on the farm?
Honeyberries.
Honeyberries, okay.
We and the birds. Birds love honeyberries. You know, if there are any bird lovers out there, man, you really could be popular if you plan to plant some honeyberries.
I wonder if as soon as the wild blackberries get ripe, maybe. Well, it's too far.
Honeyberries will be way long gone. You have to really, to grow honeyberries here, I really recommend putting bird netting over them, because the birds just, they'll eat them before they're even blue.
Uh-huh.
They're very popular.
Yeah. Are these the ones that you freeze to harvest?
No.
That's sea berry.
Yeah, sorry.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Honeyberries, as a member of the honeysuckle family, ripens along with strawberries typically at the same time.
All right. Well, I harvested my first peas, sugar pod peas, this week, and man, I tell you, I've got something going. I've got something going on in my garlic bed. I'm just going to have to give up on it. It grows well until about April, and then it doesn't get any bigger. And when I try to harvest, it's they're either rotted or they're just very small, the ones that that even do pull up.
Wow.
So I think there's some fungus going around on my area. I've tried it in a whole new bed this year. You know, it grew, germinated just fine last fall. Babied it along all, you know, spring, and nothing.
Wow.
And I talked to the garlic guru of the area, Chip Buble, who sometimes sits in your chair, Jim, and he said there is a fungus, and I can't remember what he said, that if there's anything that could be done about that.
Well, yeah, that's not good.
Okay. Caller here, our ace dirtbag listeners here. Caller wanted you to know there are two roundabouts on Stafford in Clackamas County.
Okay. Great.
Good. Now, this caller, hey, is not going to have to come in. Are there stop signs at these roundabouts? That's another question.
Right.
But even a stop sign roundabout is probably better than just a, as far as traffic flow goes.
Sure.
Yeah. All right.
Do you want to talk about the Round the World?
Yes. Sure. Yes. Just give you. You gave us a little bit of a preview here earlier.
Yeah.
This year. I mean, this hour.
Yeah. And so it's a pretty fascinating journey because it's apricot focused, which I've thought, I think listeners are probably familiar with now, that Jim Gilbert has this obsession with apricots.
We have talked about that occasionally.
Yes, that's right.
But boy, if you could come up with something.
Well, that's our goal.
You would be a very even more beloved.
Thank you,
propagator.
Right, so we go to New Jersey, and we actually have a new acquaintance there who is from Uzbekistan, works at Rutgers University, who is helping us make some connections in Uzbekistan in our quest. But there's also a renowned apricot breeder in New Jersey, and what we've discovered over the past couple of years is that breeders in general, and especially apricot breeders, are a rare breed. There aren't very many. In fact, very, very few. In fact, maybe two or three that are really actively doing this work. So we'll go visit our friend Joe Gafreda in New Jersey.
You're going to talk to all of them, apparently.
We're going to hit a couple at least.
You said there's only two or three, so.
Yeah. Well, New Zealand has one.
Oh, okay.
We've already been there.
Oh, all right.
And then I said we take this flight to Uzbekistan where our friend will meet us, and there's a couple of institutes in Uzbekistan we plan to visit. One is called the Schrader Institute. The other was part of the Soviet Union, and so they had Vavilov Institute, which was the sort of like the U.S. germplasm repository where they collect varieties of things. And according to what we know, and from the there was an apricot researcher in the Soviet Union that planted a collection of apricots there many, many years ago.
Uh-huh.
So we want to see if we can find that collection and see what's going on with it.
Well, let me just jump in here and say, in your travels before, so this is not a new passion of yours, apricots, is that correct?
Or the level to which we're working on it is new.
Yeah. So you've eaten apricots at other, like at this place in Uzbekistan, will you be able to sample? There's the wrong season for that, but they do grow them there.
Yeah, we'll be at the end of the season. We are promised apricots on the tree in Uzbekistan. So there's late ripening varieties. We'll try.
And where does the latitude? What is the latitude of those?
Yeah, it's around 37, 38. It's and a fair amount south.
Yeah, so we're 45th parallel here, roughly.
Yep.
Okay. So, but you still think that it's a possibility?
Well, apricots are grown commonly grown on the east side of in Washington.
Right. It's not
latitude is not an issue for us. It's really disease.
Yeah. Okay.
And the germplasm, we hope, in Uzbekistan will give us some more clues to how we can proceed to finding ones that might be adapted to our climate here.
Okay.
And then in Korea, where we go from Uzbekistan to Korea, and we're going to be doing kind of the same thing there. Plus, So the Koreans not only grow apricots, but they grow a species known as Japanese flowering apricot or Prunus mume, which
we've talked about. I remember
an early blooming plant that has an apricot-sized fruit that the Japanese use to make umeboshi plums, pickled plums. The fruit is not so sweet, but hybrids have been done between the two. And the Prunus mume is quite disease-resistant.
I see. I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, so we want to talk to some researchers there and see what kind of work they've done in hybridizing.
These crosses there.
Yeah, right. Plus, in Korea, it's an interesting country. It's not a big country, but they do a lot of fun things. And last year, we went to the tea-growing region of Korea, which was fascinating to see places where they actually make tea, grow and make tea. And then this time, we have a connection to a region where magnolia vine, or otherwise known as Schizandra chinensis, is grown. And we hope to visit that spot, that region.
All right.
So,
well, hopefully you'll be back in time. No delays. You said you get back Tuesday before the whatever day it is.
Show's on the 10th, I recall.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Plan to be here, and hopefully it'll be coherent.
Right.
Roll me in some stretcher or something.
Yeah. Well, we have just a little bit of time, and then we'll go out maybe with our last tune, which is another Chuck Berry song, but this time by 10 Years After. Alvin Lee and 10 Years After. But that'll come up just a little bit about seeds that I'm saving now. I always, I mentioned about the how I save green bean seeds, but I'll instead talk about saving fava beans because I use fava beans as a cover crop, and I always leave some to fully mature their seeds rather than cutting them off before they start forming seed pods, because I want all the nitrogen fixed going back to the soil rather than to the new plant. So I just let them go, let them mature. You probably don't need a whole lot, a whole number, but maybe 10 or 12 or, I don't know, 20 plants, but you'll get a lot of seeds from that many plants.
A lot of beans to eat, right?
These are cover crop seeds, so not really maybe more cattle grade than edible human, but you could. Yeah. But there's other better varieties to do that. But these are very tolerant of cold temperatures, or at least to 20 degrees. And let them dry. And, they'll even get rained on sometimes. But really, the sooner you can harvest them, the less likely it will be that they will have weevils, little beetles that will burrow into them to eat them. Although they don't eat. It seems like I can plant the seeds and they still germinate.
Even after being,
it seems just like maybe all of them have, not all of them have weevil holes, but it seems like I get at least 80% come up.
Wow.
Maybe I forget how many I plant either.
Yeah, that would be an interesting experiment to actually plant, look and find some with weevil holes and plant those in a specific spot.
I'll see what happens. I'll try to do that there too. So, all right, I think we covered everything we've got. Let's see, we're on July 10th. That's our story.
Yep.
Thanks for listening. Yep. Thank you, Ray. Okay, we forgot. We'll just talk over Alvin here talking about. We didn't give the answer to the garden stumper.
That's right.
Raspberries. They're called drupelets, and there are about 100 of them, and each one of them has to be pollinated.
And have you ever taken the raspberry apart and eaten each one individually?
No. I have taken them apart, though. Okay, thanks for listening.
Yeah. Little sucky. Rum, ma, 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 ma.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11:59.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at KBOO.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such living masters as Jimmy Cobb, Keith Jarrett, and John McLaughlin, primetime players including Stephon Harris and James Carter, and rising stars such as Grace Kelly and Orrin Evans. The weekly program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on Audio, then Podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. New shows are generally posted weekly. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Good in the Hood, the weekend of June 21st through 23rd at King School Park in Portland. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music, art, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experience to strengthen the unity in the community.
The Good in the Hood parade will take place Saturday starting at North Williams and North Russell Street at 11 a.m. and KBOO will be broadcasting the festival live on Saturday starting at 2 p.m. and Sunday starting at noon. Again, that's Good in the Hood Friday, June 21st from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday, June 22nd from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. at King School Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for KBOO News.